Hello and welcome to the Painting Podcast. I'm Jeremiah Polacek, your pilot on your pathway to becoming a better painter. In today's episode, we'll delve into the artistic journey of a man who began as an abstract expressionist and played a pivotal role in the founding of the Bay Area figurative movement, Richard Diebenkorn. As a painter myself, this is someone who has significantly influenced my own artistic journey, and so we'll explore what makes the man tick, investigate his various influences, and delve into his own approach to painting. Richard Diebenkorn was born on April 22, 1922, in Portland, Oregon. His family relocated to San Francisco when he was just 2 years old, and from the age of 4 or 5, he was a kid who consistently drew and painted. In 1940, Diebenkorn would enroll at Stanford University, where he would meet his first artistic mentors in life, professor and muralist Victor Arnautoff, who would help guide him in the classical form of discipline with oil paint, and David Mendelwitz, who shared a mutual interest in the works of Edward Hopper. In regards to Victor, he was a pretty interesting character at Stanford, somebody who was very politically active and a muralist. He painted murals all over San Francisco in places like pharmacies and hospitals and on the side of city public works buildings, these sort of things. And like many of the other muralists, like Rivera, he did have a very pro-proletarian stance that was reflected in a lot of his work. He wasn't necessarily a social realist, as you'd often associate with these types of work. His paintings were a little bit more loose and open, rather than these kind of strictly symbolic paintings. Nonetheless, he would court some controversy in 1954 when he would make a lithograph criticizing Richard Nixon. And there were even calls for the university to expel him because of this, because he was using taxpayer money to make criticisms of Richard Nixon, who would have been the vice president at the time. Since this is 1954, 1955. And also, what's going on in the 1950s, of course? We have abstract expressionism happening at the same time. And amongst all that, Victor is continuing to paint these figurative murals. And later on in life, he would actually move back to Ukraine in Mariupol, where he'd live out the rest of his life making different mosaic tile works and these types of commissions and public murals in Ukraine. But it gives you an idea of the atmosphere that Richard Diebenkorn came into, one which is firmly cemented in the broader zeitgeist. We have abstract expressionism flourishing. Yet here we have Richard Diebenkorn studying with a political activist who he sees as his mentor and somebody who's making figurative work. He was also, as a teacher, somebody who was known for instilling a lot of the classic formal disciplines associated with painting. Things just like composition and color, the basic fundamentals that are severely lacking in the current context. But Victor was also somebody who moved around a lot in life, and coming from Europe to America, he likely had a reverence for a lot of the European figurative masters as well, people like Matisse and Cézanne, would likely have come up in a lot of his discussions of composition and paint handling and these sort of things. So we can see that Diebenkorn was likely in an environment where he was heavily influenced by somebody invested in figurative painting and the ability of paintings to tell a story visually. So it's 1940, and Richard Diebenkorn is studying at Stanford. There's war raging in Europe, and some notable artists from Europe are beginning to make waves in the United States as well. And a lot of these we often associate abstract expressionism with the 1950s, but of course we can go back to the late 1930s and early 1940s and see some other early abstract expressionist painters such as Arshil Gorky and Hans Hofmann. Gorky would be recognized for his suggestive biomorphic shapes portrayed through a delicate and free-flowing and liquid application of paint. And Hans Hofmann would employ a dynamic and heavily textured brushwork in abstract yet conventionally composed works. And these people would be filtering into the American zeitgeist as well. And another significant influence on these emerging abstract movements within the United States would be the influx of surrealists and other important European avant-garde artists to the United States in the late 1930s and early 1940s, who would be escaping the dominance of Nazi-controlled Europe. These artists would profoundly inspire change in New York City painters and give them an up-close encounter with the cutting edge of European painting. So there's a lot of change going on in the world, militarily, politically. All these worlds are intertwining. And we've got Richard, whose parents want him to go to school to be a doctor or a lawyer. And he does get into Stanford, so obviously he's a very good student. But when he gets there, he doesn't declare a major, and he just takes a lot of general education classes. And this is where he'd really be exposed to different literature, music, art. He would say all of these things would open him up, citing writing as being the most important. He would later comment, "It was mostly the world of writing that opened up. Faulkner, Hemingway, Sherwood Anderson." But it wasn't all literature for Richard. During his studies, he would join a fraternity and maintain a really close-knit bond with his group of friends. And he'd later become famous on campus for falling out of a window. As Phyllis Diebenkorn recalls, quote, "Well, everybody knew who Dick Diebenkorn was after he fell out the window, because that was big stuff. He fell 4 stories and hit a bush and broke his nose. But he was very lucky. He could have been dead. And his mother said that that was what made him into an artist, and that he never wanted to be an artist before." Now, I really don't want to go too far down this path, but there actually is a correlation between some traumatic brain injuries and creativity through something called acquired savant syndrome, where somebody gets hit on the head and suddenly becomes very interested in music or fractals or mathematics or something like that. So there is some distinct and small possibility that this incident, according to his mom, is what caused his creativity. However, I think looking more broadly, we could see he was in an environment where he was already nurturing literature, music, painting, and these sorts of things already. However, the circumstances of him falling out of a window, I'm still not that sure of. I can imagine if somebody falls out of a window on a college campus, how that would generally happen, especially if you're in a fraternity with a bunch of other kind of rowdy guys. So no need to speculate too far there, but apparently, according to his mom, this fall did mark a very major change in his life and a devotion to painting. So it's the early 1940s, and Diebenkorn is attending Stanford. And while he's there, he actually visits the home of Sarah Stein, who is the sister-in-law of Gertrude Stein. And this would be the first time he would see works directly by European modernists. It's insane to imagine that somebody would just have them in their home, but they would be Cézanne's, Picasso's, and Matisse's that she had. And during this same time, he would meet his wife, Phyllis Gilman, and they'd be married in 1943. They would have two kids together, a daughter, Gretchen, and a son, Christopher. But something major would come before him getting married. In 1942, Pearl Harbor would be bombed. And just 2 months after the Pearl Harbor bombing, Richard would enlist with the United States Marine Corps, and they would assure him during his enlistment that he wouldn't be called to service as long as he was in school. And the recruiter did make some notes about him, that he had a very high moral character. But I think what was important for Richard at this time was that now that he was in the Marine Corps, he probably also had his parents kind of off of his back in a certain sense. So they wanted him to go to school to become a doctor or a lawyer or something like this. And then he kind of makes this very quick decision in the aftermath of the Pearl Harbor attack to join the United States Marine Corps. And this kind of frees him in a lot of ways. And he'd say about this period, quote, "The longest time in my whole life that I didn't do any artwork, I mean drawing or painting, was my first 2 years at Stanford. And my father had sent me there to be a professional lawyer, doctor, something. And so it wasn't until I enlisted in the military, but still stayed in college, that I began to look around, away from what I had been put in school for, which got to be boring me quite a bit." And also during this time, American involvement with the war would escalate, and Diebenkorn would form a really close bond with Professor Daniel Mendelwitz. And it's really important when you're thinking about Mendelwitz, what his own legacy and trajectory is as well. And he was a member of the Art Students League in New York, and he was heavily influenced by painters like Reginald Marsh, Charles Sheeler, and Arthur Dove. And when you look at the works of somebody like Charles Sheeler, you can also see these very simplified figures moving in space. Essentially, a lot of them are figures in interiors and in figures in landscapes. And I think there's a lot of similarities that can be drawn between Charles Sheeler and Diebenkorn. And previous to my research for this project, I'd never even thought about them. But here they are, staring me right in the face right now. Via his professor, Mendelwitz, he was most likely exposed to a lot of works by Charles Sheeler, and I can see how those works would affect his approach to painting the figure in interiors and landscapes as well. While in the military, Diebenkorn kept up with his art studies, and he'd dive deeper into European modernism. For a little bit, he'd go to school at the University of California, Berkeley, And later he'd be stationed in Quantico, Virginia. And at Berkeley, he learned from influential teachers like Worth Ryder, Erie Loran, and Eugene Newhouse. Ryder and Loran had firsthand experience with European modernism from their time studying art in Europe in the 1920s. Newhouse, who came from Germany in 1904, played a key role in making the Bay Area a hub for art appreciation and education on the West Coast. So let's get back to exactly where Richard Diebenkorn is in life. It's 1944, and he's in school. He's on the East Coast. He's going to museums. He's in Virginia, so he's going to museums in D.C., Philadelphia, New York. And his time is kind of coming up because he's going to graduate. And when you graduate, that means it's time for you to go to the front lines. So imagine his mindset and where he must have been mentally as he's looking at all these paintings. Robert Motherwell was one that he saw that he was greatly influenced by, and he'd start some of his own abstract paintings as well during this time. But then he graduates, and the war's over. So you go from probably these nightmares scenario of having to go fight literal Nazis across the ocean to, oh, the war's over, and I don't have to go. And now I get to go back to the Bay Area, one of the most idyllic places in the world. So his life took a 180 very quickly at that moment in 1945, when he did not get shipped to the front lines of World War II. Instead, he'd move back to San Francisco and enroll at what is now the San Francisco Art Institute. And it was there that he was exposed more to abstract expressionism, but really began diving into it wholeheartedly. He'd go on a 10-month residency to Woodstock, New York, where he'd further develop abstract expressionist paintings that were fully abstract. And then he'd return back to San Francisco, complete his studies. And then by 1947, he already had a job working there. And during the same time, Clifford Still, one of the most famous early abstract painters, would also be teaching at the San Francisco Art Institute alongside him from 1947 to 1950. So on the East Coast, you began to have these monumental abstract expressionist painters beginning to get, you know, known throughout the country and known throughout the world as the art world shifted from Paris to New York during this same time period. And you'd have people like Willem de Kooning become rising to prominence in New York City. But equally, in a much less important art market, but still very important nonetheless, on the West Coast, you really had Diebenkorn as one of the first progenitors of abstract expressionism on the West Coast. And he became very, very well known early on as an abstract expressionist painter. So it's the early 1950s, and Diebenkorn is still kind of soaking that GI Bill for everything it's got, and he'll go to the University of New Mexico in the Graduate Fine Arts Department, which kind of seems odd, doesn't it, that he's teaching at the San Francisco Art Institute, and then he's like, I'm going to go to grad school. So things were a little bit different back then. And here in the early 1950s, he'd continue to develop his abstract expressionist style. And then in 1952, he'd take a faculty position at the University of Illinois in Urbana for the academic year of 1952-1953. And he'd teach painting during his time there at the University of Illinois. And then in November and December of 1952, he'd have his first major solo exhibit at the Paul Cantor Gallery in Los Angeles. And in 1953, he'd return back to the San Francisco Bay Area. And he'd take a teaching position at the California College of Arts and Crafts in 1955. And he'd teach there until 1958. But it was the evolution of his style in the mid-1950s that I'd really like to highlight. And those were done during the first few years he was living in Berkeley, when Diebenkorn would shift from strict abstract expressionism to a more representational style. And by the mid-1950s, he became a significant figurative painter who would bridge the gap between people like Matisse and abstract expressionism. And he'd form a group which would later be referred to as the Bay Area Figurative Movement, along with other artists like Elmer Bischoff, David Park, James Weeks, and others. But the subject matter of these paintings was something very, very simple, and something that's so often forgot about today. And he went back to the most basic of compositions that one could imagine. Maybe he was thinking about his classes with Victor 5-6 years previous, but he just began painting interiors, figures in interiors, landscapes, still lifes, and the human figure. And that's pretty much all there is to a lot of painting when you're looking at people like Matisse or Cézanne or Picasso. What else is there but figures in interiors, figures in exteriors, landscapes? And this would consume his work during this period that would really serve as a bridge out from abstract expressionism and into figurative painting. And a lot of the paintings that you would see during this time period, he plays a lot with the picture plane. So you'll see a figure, but they're kind of treated in the exact same way as the rest of the environment is. So when you're looking at a painting where the figure is highlighted and isolated as the most important piece, I don't know, maybe a Bouguereau or something like this, you can see that all the focus is meant to be on the figure itself. That figure is the most important thing. With abstract painting, and with all over abstract painting, the entire canvas itself kind of becomes the most important thing. And so in many of these abstract figurative works that you see created by Diebenkorn, you'll see an approach to the figure that is identical to the approach of the things around it. So the bench is just as important as the chin of the person sitting on the bench. They're treated exactly the same. And you'll also notice that he intentionally will use colors in the background to pop forward and create this tension in his paintings between figure and ground, where sometimes it almost seems like the figure itself is receding back into the image while the negative space in the image wants to push forward, wants to come forward in space. There's a tension between the two. So it's the early 1960s now, and Diebenkorn has gone from being a prominent abstract expressionist painter to becoming a prominent figurative painter. And around 1961, he'd begun to start producing some dry points and etchings after he got introduced to it while working at a university. And then in 1963, he'd become Stanford's first artist in residence, a position which held no responsibilities other than having to meet with students when they wanted to. What an amazing approach to an artist residence to just, you know, we're going to put somebody and we're going to give them a studio And students, you can come and sign up for a time to speak to them if you wish by signing your name on this sheet or whatever. It's just an amazingly simple approach, but something that I can't imagine would happen any longer. But anyway, he's in Stanford, and he gets to just work and have a free studio for a year. And so he's continuing to make all of these figurative works. Then around 1963 to 1964, he'd receive a travel grant to go visit all the Matisses held in these various Soviet-era museums at the time. So he'd go and travel, and he visited all these different Matisses throughout the world, many of which were behind the Iron Curtain at the time. But there was a couple of paintings which really stood out and became extremely influential to both Diebenkorn as well as the Bay Area figurative movement. And they were View of Notre Dame and Woman on a High Stool by Matisse, both of which were created by Matisse in early 1914 during his experimental period. And both paintings suggest that they were actually more complex in the early stages. So Matisse likely made these paintings as he normally would, and then later on, he just simplified them down to the simplest of elements that one could imagine. For instance, in View of Notre Dame, we see a blue rectangle with interceding lines representing streets, a small green circle area with a black shadow near it to represent a tree, and this sort of boxy thing. You know, just this little boxy thing representing a building. So it's as minimal as you can possibly get with abstraction, but it's also still playing with representation, and it's still playing with that approach to the picture plane where abstraction is already present. We're already seeing it more as an abstract painting than we are as a representational painting. And remember, these paintings are done in 1914. So that was 50 years later, after these paintings, that they become influential to Diebenkorn and the Bay Area figurative painters, as well as color field paintings, which we'll see as Diebenkorn comes through with another phase of his artwork, moving towards abstract, minimalist color field paintings. And they would also incorporate this same approach that was present in the abstract works that we saw previously, but we don't see the gesture and the splashiness. But with the Ocean Park series, we see a more refined geometric abstraction. And the Ocean Park series, they would begin around 1966, 1967. And a lot of these are paintings that seem almost aerial in nature, like you're in an airplane looking down at the ground and you see all these little squares of where fields are and where streets are and how they're all divided by this big blue ocean on one side. It can also be just a view from a simple window and how the landscape beyond that window morphs into these simple rectangles and squares and triangles and these sorts of things. And it is within color field painting that we also have an approach to painting where we see large fields of color, and just the presence of that color is the driving force for the emotional impact on the viewer. So when we're looking at a color field painting, we're focusing solely on the color. Everything else is stripped out. But Diebenkorn gives us just a little bit more. He allows us to see some of the landscape, and he harkens back to a time much older than abstract expressionism. He goes back to a figurative painter, Matisse, in a very, very particular time in 1914, and it is those paintings that propel the entire Ocean Park series So when we see the Ocean Park series, we may be thinking about the flatness of the surface and the color field aspect of it, and just the colors interacting and how they play and how they're so beautiful. But there's also that glimmer of representation still there. We still see the beaches and the sky and the ocean. And I think that's an absolute gift that Diebenkorn has given us all through his abstract work and through his representational work and through both of them, because he's the absolute perfect bridge of both ever since Henri Matisse. So, thanks a lot for listening. That's an overview of Diebenkorn, his life, legacy, and inspirations for his work. If you like this sort of thing, please like and subscribe. And I don't have any advertisers, I don't do any of that, but you can check out oko.academy. If you're in Prague, I'm teaching painting, I teach drawing, still lifes, figure drawing nights, these sorts of things. So if you're in Prague or you want to visit Prague and take a class, we can make that happen. Thanks a lot for listening, and happy painting.